Welcome to the final lecture in the 2013 Nature of Things lecture series. Tonight we're going to hear from evolutionary anthropologist Brian Hare. I'm Sarah George. I'm the executive director of the Natural History Museum of Utah, and I want to thank all of you for joining us tonight at the City Library. We'd also like to welcome our radio audience listening on KCPW 88.3 and 105.3 FM. This year's theme, The Science of Being Human, has provided some wonderful discussions that have helped us understand exactly what it is about our species that makes us truly unique. Kicking off the series, we heard from Louise Leakey talking about some of her new fossil finds in Africa. We then heard from Dr. June Round, who's a pathologist at the University of Utah, talking about the symbiosis of microorganisms in humans. And then our keynote was David Eagleman, who related his research on how the human brain constructs perception, why brains operate so differently from one another, and why this matters for society. I want to take a moment to acknowledge the support of our sponsors and our partners. For the seventh year in a row, the Nature of Things series is underwritten by a generous gift from the R. Harold Burton Foundation. And we cannot say thank you enough. We'd also like to thank our presenting partner, J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as sponsors Rio Tinto Kennecott Utah Copper, the Clark Foundation, and Myriad Genetics. And then we have wonderful in-kind partners, the City Library, for having us here tonight, Liberty Heights Fresh, Pinion Market and Cafe, and Kingsbury Hall. We really are grateful. We also want to thank our media partner, KCPW, in Salt Lake City. They do a great job of getting the word out so that people who will learn about the lecture and then broadcasting it so that if you can't come, you can listen to it. I also invite you to listen to the podcasts, which are on the museum's website, nhmu.utah.edu. And then finally, a very special thanks to the voters of Salt Lake County for making the Zoo Arts and Parks Foundation Fund possible. And that supports the museum and many other cultural organizations so that we're able to bring these programs to you free of charge. So thank you. Now for tonight's speaker. According to Dr. Brian Hare, the only way to understand what it is to be human is to know what it is like to be not human. Through his extensive research, Dr. Hare has compared the human mind to that of the bonobo and the chimpanzee, as well as the minds of our more distant relatives, like dogs. Dr. Hare is an associate professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University in North Carolina, and he's a member of the school's Center for Cognitive Neuroscience. He founded the Hominoid Psychology Research Group while at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, and subsequently founded the Duke Canine Cognition Center after taking his current position at Duke University. He recently published The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think, with his wife, Vanessa Woods, and he is also the founder and chief scientific officer of the citizen science company, Dognition.com. Dr. Hare has shared his research in several NOVA episodes on animal intelligence, and in the PBS series, The Human Spark. So please join me in welcoming Brian Hare.
How are y'all? Good. So it's a real delight, pleasure to be here. I hadn't been in Utah since I came to ski as a kid. So it's been so fun to see how excited Utah is about science and to be blown away by the museum that you have here. And I have to tell you the magical moment. the magical moment I had that I would never have expected. Okay, there are dinosaurs. That's great. I've seen dinosaurs before. And then you turn, and there's this wall of Triceratops. Dozens of species, apparently, that I thought there was like one or two. This is amazing. And then on a nice cladogram that shows their phylogenetic or evolutionary relationship, I almost fell over. It was so cool. So I was totally blown away. So I had a great experience. You're very, very lucky to have a museum like that that then can host events like this. So thank you to Sarah George, to Lisa Thompson, who's been hosting me, and to you guys for coming to hear about our my research and the research of the people that I work with. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about dogs and bonobos today. But before I start, I would be I wouldn't be a good psychologist if I didn't test you. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to really think about what it is to be human and why it is that we sit around doing what we're doing right now. Why is it that we're able to build buildings? Why are we cognitive the way that we are? What is it that makes our species unique and special? But we're going to do that by thinking about other species. So here's our first go at this. We have Yo-Yo the chimpanzee. She's a juvenile chimpanzee, and I have presented her with a problem she's never seen before. There is a tube that is, there's a plexiglass tube here, and it's attached to these bars. She can't remove the tube. And in the bottom of the tube, there is what's the equivalent of finding a new dinosaur species. Or getting your diploma from Utah University, I don't know which. Okay, three peanuts. That is a big deal to a chimpanzee, okay? But the problem is that being an experimentalist, we have taken away all of the standard solutions that she would use, putting a stick in the tube or maybe a rock to smash it open, whatever else. We have everything in here that you would need to keep a chimpanzee happy, but the typical tools she has are not available. She's going to solve this problem in under 10 seconds. The question is, can you keep up? So here we go. See if you can figure out the solution before she does. Don't scream it out if you do. Just be proud of yourself internally. Okay, so she uses water to fill up the tube. Peanuts float. They float to the top. She's able to eat the peanuts that otherwise she would not be able to have access to. Now, there's another solution to this problem. Those of you who yelled out water and couldn't inhibit, maybe there is another solution and somebody knows it, okay? Somebody who thought that this was actually not that hard of a problem. Does anybody know the second solution? Okay, we've got suction as an example. Anybody else? Anybody else before I give you a hint? Break the tube with what? Okay, there's not, teeth would not work, but good idea. You would just break your teeth. Oh, okay. A rock. Yes, if she had one, she could do that. That would be a great idea. Okay, my hint is it's a very male solution. And only the males did it. Pee in the tube, that's right. Okay. So, we share this planet with intelligent life. And what we're going to talk about today is what is intelligence. And I show you that example because it's very easy as a human standing out up here after doing lots of science and all the academic accolades that I might have, thinking that I'm incredibly intelligent and more intelligent than other species on the planet. Well, it depends on how you define intelligence. So that's what we're going to talk about. This, I think, is sort of a traditional approach to thinking about intelligence, is you've got more or less of it. We all, how many people here have not taken a standardized test? Okay, so very few people. The rest of you know, you take a standardized test and what happens? You get a number. And that number means you are a 42, or you are an 800, or you are a 35. You go talk to your friend, they have a different number. And then you get worried about that. Or you get really excited and feel great about it. Right. So, I think that a lot of people and in a lot of institutions, this is how we think about intelligence. But unfortunately, it's way more complicated than that. And even though this is the way we think about it, and this is the best way we currently have to measure it at large scale, the reality looks more like this. There's lots of different types of intelligence, and we don't even know how to measure them in a standardized fashion. And it gets even worse than that, because it ends up that even though you have lots of different types of intelligence, they can differ. And you can have a lot of one and a little bit of the other. But then, when I say you have a lot of the other, a little bit of one and a lot of the other, well, maybe that's great if you have a little bit of one strategy. Maybe it's good to be uninhibited if you're going to be on the football pitch. Maybe it's really, really good to not be very good at social learning if everybody you're surrounded with always has the wrong solution. So context really matters. So it gets even worse when you start comparing species or individuals, because you can have a different profile for a different species and a different individual. It's very hard to measure this in any standardized form, but it's why all of us are intuitively unsatisfied with standardized tests. That's why we still interview people, even though there's a wonderful set of studies showing that we're horrible at interviewing and it doesn't predict much about people's success on how you interview them. So there's different types of intelligence, and what I would say the thesis of today will be is that when you study different species of animals, and we're going to talk about comparisons between different species, you learn that actually an animal that is as vapid as a dog can at the same time be a genius. And the goal, and I think the hope in the future, is that maybe we could start thinking about our own species in a similar way. There is genius in places we don't expect it, whether we're talking about individuals or groups of people. And the question is, can you find a way to express it? Can you find a way to measure it? Can you find a way to nurture it? So I have two guiding questions in all the research that I do. What is it that makes us human? And how did we get that way? And I'm very lucky at Duke that I have access to some really fun resources. I actually do work with humans. This is one of our representatives in our species. And then I work with our two closest relatives, bonobos and chimpanzees. Then I also have the Duke Canine Cognition Center, where I study people's pet dogs. People locally bring their pet dogs in to play fun games, and we do some basic research to understand how their dogs think. And we also have the Duke Lemur Center. Mostly what I'm going to talk about is our work at the Duke Canine Cognition Center and our work with bonobos. Sorry, lemurs, but they're also awesome. Okay, so basically, it's as complicated as this. And just imagine how embarrassing this can be when you're at a conference with geneticists and neurobiologists. And I'm like, okay, here's the method. I put a couple of cups on the ground, I hide something, and then I see if the animal can find it. So this is my MRI machine, these two little tumbler cups here. It doesn't cost much. But what I'd like to argue is that it is equally powerful and has better resolution. So much research has happened in the last 10 years, and part of what is so exciting to be in front of you is to be able to share with you the fact that there, in the last 10 years, we've made more discoveries about dog psychology than we had in the previous 100. And basically, science woke up, and we've discovered what is remarkable about dogs. And there is a lot of interest and attention right now on dog psychology. Whereas if you go back in the literature 15 years ago, it was completely silent. Not much interest. Why would you study dogs? So the video I showed you of Yo-Yo solving the tube problem is a wonderful example of inferential reasoning. I can't see the solution. I can't just simply perceive it. I have to actually imagine what the solution might be. I have to put two things together I've never seen put together and solve a new problem that I've never seen before. So that's what I'm really, really interested in when I study cognition in animals. So I don't blame people that initially they weren't that excited about dogs, because you wouldn't necessarily think that that's what dogs are capable of. But we've actually discovered some nice evidence that in some contexts, dogs are capable of inference. The other thing is that, as I showed you, there are different types of intelligence and different strategies that animals use to make a living. That's along the lines of what we've discovered as well with dogs, is what is their genius? What is it that's made them so successful? Pause for a second, and here in Utah, it's a very sensitive topic. Wolves. I know, it's very sensitive. Wolves in most places where they range historically or prehistorically are gone. They are not humans as a species. I'm sure there are people here who love wolves. I do too. As a species, they're not, sorry, for our species, they're not our favorite species. Evolutionarily, they were direct competitors as we left Africa. They eat the same thing we do. We leave as modern humans as hypercarnivores. We enter a world enter a world with an entire predatory guild of maybe 10, 15 species in the Middle East and Europe. And within many thousand years, every single species except for the wolf and the brown bear are gone. How annoyed those people must have been that the wolves wouldn't go away. They got rid of everything else, either through direct competition or by eating almost all the food so that the other species couldn't make it anymore. But the wolf somehow survived. So wolves are not a very beloved species, if you think evolutionarily for humans, and cross-culturally, not particularly fond of them. So the fact that in your bed you may sleep with a wolf is a bit of a shock. The fact that during the recession of 2008, where our economy had some problems and a lot of people lost a lot of jobs, unfortunately, you will be surprised, fascinated to learn there was a job boom for dogs. In the age of the internet and in the age of iPads, etc., dogs are doing better than ever. Their economy has diversified. And there is a huge supply problem. So, zero unemployment. So how can it be that this species that is completely reviled is now beloved? How is that possible? Whatever the answer to that question is, that's the genius of dogs. And that's what the book is all about, is trying to figure out that puzzle. So it all started with this mutt. He was a Labrador Retriever. He even had papers. And my mother, who's here, felt very bad, guilty, at least this is how she tells the story, because I was no longer going to be the youngest, which I apparently told her was a horrible thing at 7 or 8. I had a family, 4 kids in our litter, my little brother's on the way, mom feeling bad, has to do something for the now ex-youngest, and she brings home Oreo. So Oreo was absolute best friend growing up. We went everywhere together. Anywhere in the neighborhood, he was behind me. We got into lots of trouble together. And of course, absolutely adored Oreo, just like you all adore your best friends. But Oreo had one funny thing that is very Labrador-esque. He loved tennis balls. And not only did he love tennis balls, but he had to have multiple tennis balls. He wasn't happy with one tennis ball. He had to at least have 2. That was okay, but really the best was to have 3. This is actually one of 2 photos we have of Oreo. And he actually could get a 3rd one back there in the back of his mouth. And he absolutely had to have 3 tennis balls. If he had 3 tennis balls, he's the happiest guy in the world. But the problem is that meant that you were his victim. So he would find you and wherever you were, bleh, throw the tennis balls out, and then you were supposed to throw them everywhere. Now, a tennis ball becomes a Labrador slobber sponge. And then there's 3 of them, and wherever you are, doing whatever you're supposed to be doing, you know, friend's house, mother there, it just can be bad. But he loved to play fetch, so you throw the ball, and he'd run off. And sometimes, because you didn't want to play fetch anymore because he had all these tennis balls with slobber everywhere, you'd throw the ball somewhere where he couldn't see it and hope that he would just kind of give up on it and maybe he would go do something else. Of course, he didn't. And what did he do is what every Labrador does is he'd go get the first one, come back, look at you, wait for a second, and then start, woo, 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 woo. Yes, and it's annoying after a while, and he doesn't stop until you either produce the ball or you point to where the ball is. And then if you point, he runs off in that direction. Okay, so that's nothing so remarkable, but that was my experience as a kid. So I then go to college. I go to Emory University, and there I meet Mike Tomasello, a preeminent developmental psychologist, who is working on the idea that what's special and unique and important about humans is a crucial change during our development, early, that allows us to participate in culture and learn language. It's a very simple thing that happens between 9 and 12 months. There's a revolution in human development where you start understanding that others are like you, that you can learn from them, and that you can pay attention to their gestures and to where they're looking and to the sounds they're making and learn things about the world that you can't understand. Now imagine you're 9 months old, you're not that good at moving around, so you want to know what this tool out there can do for you. And so then you start paying attention and trying to interact with it. All right, so the hypothesis was not just that this is amazing, this develops, that it allows for language and culture, or that those later abilities that allow for language and culture scaffold on top of that. It was that it was unique to humans. And the evidence for that was the fact that we had worked with chimpanzees, done very simple games to look at the ability of chimpanzees to read human gestures. The game's very simple. It's actually illustrated here. There are two cups on the ground. You hide food in one of two places. The animal knows that the food is hidden, or the kid, the child. Actually, with kids, you use stickers. You hide a sticker of food, and then you just tell them where it is by pointing or looking at it, and they find it. It's that simple. You're just trying to help them find something they want. You have to hide it first so that they don't know where it is. So the evidence that supported the, one of the pieces of evidence that supported the hypothesis was that chimpanzees were horrendous at this test. As intelligent as Yo-Yo is, on the little bubble for reading gestures in this context, it's really small. So that then got everybody really excited that this is crucial to human evolution. We shared a common ancestor 5 to 7 million years ago. Since we split off, that must be a change that's important that allows for language and culture. So as a 19-year-old who didn't know any better and having been raised by Oreo, I said, I think my dog can do that. And so then Mike said, well, everybody says their dog can do calculus. What are you talking about? And I was like, no, really, really. And I told the story of playing fetch with Oreo, and he was intrigued, and he was then proved what is greatness as a scientist. He was really excited he might be wrong in a really interesting way. And so he said, why don't we do an experiment? So that's then what happened. We went and took our my mom and dad. I went back. I grew up in Atlanta. They live in Atlanta still, in the same house, and I went home from Emory with my laundry, of course, and dutifully while my mother was washing my clothes, I then started playing with Oreo, who was still alive at the time, and my little brother's dog. He'd managed to get a dog too, named Daisy. So I went home and played these games with Oreo and Daisy, and it was very simple. It's as I described. You just hide the food and you just tell them where it is, and they were great at it. They were fantastic. They solved it from the first trial, and they had no problem solving that problem. Well, that's not a surprise. You guys all know that your dog seems to be able to read what you're trying to tell them in many contexts. If you're a dog owner, you know this. If you're a scientist who doesn't have a dog and have a big hypothesis, you didn't know that. But then we started doing a little bit more complicated things, because what kids do is it's not just when you point for a child that they go where you point. They do more than that. They're very flexible. They actually understand what you're trying to tell them. They understand your communicative intention. They understand you're trying to help them. And that's why if you just look, or you kind of scoot towards where it is, or you know, you even shake your foot in that direction, they may not have seen you do that before, but they understand what you're trying to tell them. Okay? It's not that they've slowly learned this. They can infer that you're trying to tell them something because they know that you're trying to help them. Okay? It's very, very different than just repeatedly through trial and error learning, oh, when this thing moves over on this side, I go in that direction, good things happen. Okay? So we did this type of test where we just looked to where the food was. That's nothing I had done with Oreo and Daisy before. They were fantastic at it still. Then we tested dogs. We switched and started testing lots of dogs. And the next question we asked is, well, can dogs understand the information from other dogs? And the answer is yes. They're really good at this. Then we did a really hard test if you're a great ape. This is just mean if you're a great ape, okay? If you're a child below the age of two, it's also kind of a really tough test. If you're beyond two, it's a piece of cake. So hopefully you're all normally functioning and you'll understand. The idea is that you basically place a novel indicator, in this case a block painted black and white, on the location where the food is. And then you see what the dog does. Can the dog use this novel information to find the food? And the answer is they're brilliant at it. It's very easy for them. Now, there are a couple things to know. You all now are sitting there being great experimentalists going, hey, dogs have great noses. This is all really interesting, but they can smell the food. They don't need you to tell them where it is. So, of course, we looked at that, and if you give them no information, like this, they're completely at chance. Chance is 50-50. There are two options. We only count as correct, just like on your standardized test, your first choice. You don't get to go to one of the cups and then say, oh, no, it's not in that one, it's in this one. Okay? I have no doubt that if we actually gave them credit for whichever one they went to whenever, that they would find it. I know that they could use their nose to sniff around and find it. But if they have to walk from 2 meters away and go directly to where the food is, they cannot do that with their nose. And I'm not the only one who's found that. It's actually been replicated by 7 different labs, and there's 12 or 15 publications. So this is a real phenomenon. And it's even more fun than that. But I'll skip the details. Back to this condition, though, I want to tell you one fun thing. Is even if the dog doesn't see you put the block, they use the information. So if you put an occluder, something they can't see through, you just show them the block and then you place it. They go and use that spontaneously. But here's the fun part. Before and after you do these tests, if you make the dog leave the room and then you put the block and then you leave the room and bring the dog back, they don't use the block to find the food. You have to touch it and they have to know that you put it there before it becomes information they will use. The only other species that does that is humans. So, if you're a great ape fan, this is very depressing. And I'm a big great ape fan. So here we go. Here's Fifi. She is incredibly intelligent. If you would like to be deceived and robbed of your peanuts or grapes, she can do it. But if you want to help her and tell her where something is, she is totally flummoxed. Here's a grape. I'm going to put it in one of these two cups. You'll see the second cup in a second. And then I'm going to put a block on it. Try to tell her where it is. So I hide the grape. It goes under one of the cups. I just tell her where it is. There it is, Fifi. You can do this over and over and over and over again, and she'll be at 50%. Now, maybe once or twice, you might think, oh, he's lying, he's deceiving. No, we're always honest. We always put it where the food is, blah, blah, blah. And this is very hard for them. They have to learn through trial and error. After you do 36, 50 trials, okay, I get it, the block, I go there, that's where the food is. But if you then do something new, let's say that I put a triangle, or now I tap on where it is, or whatever, completely fall back to chance again. So what about this scruffy mutt down here? If I can get my little cursor over there. There we go. First trial, never seen it before. Okay, whatever, there's this blue thing. I don't know what's going on. I can't even really see blue. All right, cups, got it. Block, no problem, food must be over there. Okay, he's talking about it. Okay, yeah, I'll go get it. So first trial success, and if you're into data, here's the heartbreaker. It's bad. The dogs do much better than the chimpanzees. They're not perfect. There is variability. Some dogs are perfect, some dogs less than perfect. But as a group, when you look at dogs, they are really amazing at this relative to chimpanzees. So Mike Tomasello, who I introduced to you as the person with the theory about these gestures being unique to humans, we wrote a paper together that basically says human-like skills in dogs? And it's really a question. But we make the argument that the things that dogs are doing are so flexible and sophisticated in this domain that they are the only species that rival what happens during a crucial developmental moment in our own species. So I talk in more detail about all of this in the book. But of course, if that's true, if what I just said is true, that's really weird. Where did that come from? What is that? How did that get in dogs? The answer is not only fun and interesting because it tells us about dogs, but it ends up, I think, telling us a lot about ourselves. So, to make a very, very long story short, we went and tested wolves, because wolves are the closest relative of dogs, of course. Maybe it's just canids are really good at this. It's just apes or primates aren't very good at this kind of game. Canids, you could imagine, could be just as a group are really good. It's not that dogs are special. They're just in a group of animals that are really sensitive to the information of other species. If you're a wolf, it'd be great to know which direction a deer is going to go next based on some cue that it gives off, where it's looking or which foot it put down, which direction. So we went and tested wolves, and they look like the chimpanzees. And subsequently, people have raised wolves in the identical manner as a group of dogs for the purpose of then testing them in these tests. And you find the same thing. Even crazier than that is if you give those dogs a preference test between humans and other dogs, who they want to be with, they want to be with humans. You give the same test to the wolves, they want to hang out with wolves. So, we talk about the work on wolves and dogs being compared. But another obvious explanation, which actually was harder to test than the wolf hypothesis, is puppies. We interact with our dogs for thousands of hours. Maybe the reason they can solve these problems is because it's just a trial and error issue. They've just had so much experience interacting with us. We tell them what to do all the time or where to find things. They've just figured out slowly over time, most of the data that I showed you from those studies would have been from adults, not from little nine-month-old, the equivalent of a nine-month-old human infant. So we tested puppies, and I'm telling you, I thought this was the answer. And so did Mike. And the surprise is, it's not. So as young, now we know, it's not my own research. I looked from 9 to 24 months, but now that people have gone as young as 9 to 24 weeks. People have gone as young as 6 weeks. Dogs are spontaneously using human gestures and social information to solve these types of problems. They barely even have adult vision at 6 weeks. They can barely see, and they are solving these problems like human infants. So whatever it is, it may require experience, but it is not an immense amount of experience. So then that left one hypothesis that we could think of, and that was a hypothesis regarding domestication. Maybe something happened during domestication. Maybe dogs actually survived and reproduced better because they have these abilities. Or maybe just domestication as a result creates this as something that's advantageous to dogs. So it ended up, I went to study New Guinea singing dogs in Oregon. I didn't have to go to a far off place. And the neat thing about New Guinea singing dogs is that we know now from genetic work that this is one of the most wolf-like, genetically wolf-like dogs. They're very closely related to dingoes, Australian dingoes, Southeast Asian dingoes. They have telltale signs of domestication, but they've been feral for thousands of years. So, how fun to go look at an animal that's domesticated but hasn't been under direct human selection, especially during the Victorian period where all the European breeds originate from. I don't know if you know, but most of the breeds we think of in all the kennel clubs are about 150 years old. Most dogs, the best evidence we have is somewhere between 12 and 40,000 years ago is the origin of the dog. But most people would argue for an origin age of about 12,000 years if you take into account the archaeological record. So most dogs would have been like this dog for the majority of their evolutionary history. These guys are great at using human gestures and cues, even though they have not undergone this second level of selection. But the really most powerful test would be to study an animal that I domesticated myself. We could go and say, hey, let's domesticate some dogs from wolves, and then let's see if they can do this. And then we'll know what happened. Well, we will have been the one making the selection, and we'll know what the selection pressure is. Well, that's kind of depressing, because that would take a while. And the worst kind of science is the science that leads to an untestable idea. You're leaving the realm of science. If you can't falsify your idea, then you're stuck. And so I thought I was stuck until I learned about these critters. So in Russia, there was an experiment that has now been going on for over 50 years where a population of foxes were selected each year when they reached 7 months of age. They were selected based on a single criterion. Did they approach a human? Another population was kept the exact amount of time and kept in the exact same conditions, in the exact same farm, but they were not selected for whether they approach or ran away from humans. And as a result, what you end up with after 20 generations is a population of foxes that have all of these characteristics. The line that was selected to approach humans has an incredibly high rate of floppy ears. They have the white spot that you often see on domesticated animals on their forehead called the star mutation. They have curly tails, piebald coats, feminized cranium, their skeletal gracilization, which means their bones got thinner, less robust than the control line. They have some physiological changes related to aggression and risk-taking and activity. And behaviorally, they love to approach humans, I can tell you, because I went to visit them. They are obsessed with people, just like your own dog. If you come within, if they can see you, you will hear, because they're kept in groups, you'll hear, imagine dozens and dozens of these foxes crying like little baby fox kits. They wag their tail, and unfortunately, if you pick them up, they pee for joy. And it's particularly unfortunate because they still obviously have musk glands, and you then smell like that the rest of the day. So basically, if you look like this when you're 7 months old, this is a fox being touched, you will get to reproduce and have babies. If you look like this as an experimental fox running away in the corner of the cage, you don't get to reproduce. And you end up with this. So all they did was select on the behavior that you're interested in non-aggressive to people, and you get all these changes. Essentially, this work was led by Dmitry Belaev, and it was carried on by Ludmila Trutt. Those two people, along with Irene Plyasnina, my own collaborator, had uncovered what domestication is. Domestication is selection against aggression. For all intents and purposes, the traits that they see here are the same traits you see universally as a suite in animals that we consider domesticated. Now, maybe after you see these original changes, we then go in as humans and artificially select for certain of these traits even more and make them even more extreme. But essentially, they had uncovered what domestication is. Domestication is selection against aggression. Well, that's very, very simple. So the fun thing about this is that I went to study the foxes. And the prediction is that if domestication, defined as selection against aggression, is the cause of what we see in dogs, then you would predict the experimental line should look like dogs. The Russians didn't select them to be more flexible and communicative with humans. But maybe just like all, they also didn't select for floppy ears. So maybe just like floppy ears, the experimental foxes are going to look like dogs. The control line that doesn't have the same prevalence of all these traits should look like wolves or chimpanzees. So we go, we do our tests. It's a long, fun story we tell in the book. It involves nudity, vodka, sauna, railroads across Siberia. You can read about it. But the answer is that the experimental foxes look like dogs. They use our gestures like dogs do. So, OMG, it means that selection against aggression or survival of the friendliest can lead to more social flexibility and a type of social problem solving that is at the heart of the genius of dogs. The reason that dogs have been so successful is because they can understand what we're trying to tell them and because they're interested in us and they approach us. So when you start talking about our own species, you can imagine one of the big things that has to happen is we have to be able to sit like this. And we have to be able to share the spoils of any joint effort we make. And so it starts to make you think, if you can do this artificially, surely nature, and there's lots of evidence that species vary in how aggressive they are, maybe nature itself, through natural selection, can select animals to be more or less aggressive. But again, you know that I'm going to have a problem because, unless anybody knows a baby Neanderthal, I want to meet you afterwards, I'm going to be having a hard time testing my hypothesis. Because if there's selection and aggression, and that's what led to a change between the Australopiths and Homo, or if that's what led to a change between archaic and modern humans, or that's what led to a change in our common ancestor with bonobos and chimpanzees and our own lineage, then I have to do comparisons just like we've done here. So what am I going to do? Well, one idea is to be really, really excited about the fact that we have two closest relatives. I don't know if you know that, but it's delightful to learn that we have two closest relatives. So that's what I want to tell you about. I want to tell you about bonobos because they can help us test this hypothesis. But before I do that, I want to show you a video. And I'm going to have to leave my presentation to do it. But before I do that, I just want to ask a question. And it's going to seem random, but that's fun. So you go to Vegas. All right? You win. Okay, maybe this isn't already sounding very realistic, but it can happen. You go to Vegas. You win $100. All right? You go home. You're really excited. What do you do? What are you more likely to do? Or what's your preference, let's say? It's even better. And are you going to share that money with somebody you know or somebody who's in your family? Or are you going to share some of that money with somebody you've never met before? So if you think that you would prefer to share the money with somebody you know and maybe a family member, raise your hand. Okay, that's pretty robust. All right, so if you think you'd like to share with somebody you've never met before, raise your hand. Okay, some very special people. Good. Good. That's wonderful. Okay. So let me just switch over. Unfortunately, I have to leave here to show you this video. So I just asked bonobos the same question I asked you. So this is Susie Quatenda. She's the first Congolese student ever to study bonobo psychology. And this was her idea. It was sort of like my, dogs can do that moment. She said, I think bonobos can really share with one another. And what we did is she put food in this room, and there's a key that a bonobo can come into the room and has the choice of either eating all the food or opening the key and letting another bonobo in to eat the food together. So this is Sake. She's about 5 years old. Unfortunately, she's an orphan of the bushmeat trade. There's your key. All she has to do is pull the key out of the door. She can open the door and share food. But no self-respecting chimpanzee would ever do that. There would be no experiment, which is why I was so skeptical. They would just eat all the food. Why would you do anything but just eat all the yummy food? This is before her breakfast. She's very hungry. Starts to eat the food. Okay, she's a chimpanzee. So what we found is that bonobos actually prefer to share food and eat together than to just eat by themselves. It's very French. But it's crazier than that. Because when we asked them the next question, which was the question I asked you, what if in the other room you have the choice between somebody you've never met before or somebody who's your brother, sister, mother, whatever, kin, or even just a groupmate? Well, they like to share with the individual they've never met before. So they have a completely different preference than we do. Sorry, I'm just switching back to the presentation. Okay, so let me go back one slide. A bonobo, what is it? Well, first of all, it's one of our closest relatives, one of our two. This is the phylogeny of our family tree. And bonobos and chimpanzees split. We now know a little bit under a million years ago from chimpanzees. From a common ancestor with chimpanzees. We actually don't know much about this common ancestor, except for what we can glean by comparing these two species. But what's so exciting about these two species is that in many ways, in the traits we care most about and understanding about ourselves, they differ from one another. They're completely opposite from each other. They're yin and yang. So they're like wolves and dogs in terms of their genetics, but they're like wolves and dogs in terms of their behavioral differences, or potentially their cognitive differences. At least that's what we were interested in finding out. So if anybody asks you, what is a bonobo? Here's what I want you to remember. Little Mimi is not dominated by Big Tatongo. They really violate almost a lawful relationship between how big you are and who gets what. So how in the world can Little Mimi, who's only 33 kilos, very easily dominate Big Tatonga? So she does it with girl power. Because what happens is, bonobo females, if there's a problem in the group, particularly around an infant, if there's a problem in the group, and it's always a male that's up to something, then females work together and, as the Congolese say, correct that male. I.e., they scare the bejesus out of him and chase him all over the place and let him know that, no, you're not going to be aggressive and violent towards anybody in our group. But there's some really interesting observations that have happened as a result of that. There's no evidence, unlike chimpanzees, who actually are now famous for lethal aggression. They will raid neighboring territories, they'll kill individuals in their neighboring groups. They then take the territory over many years after systematically killing individuals in the neighboring group, and then they obviously start to mate with the females in that neighboring group after all the males have been wiped out and the infants of those males as well. So there's a darker side to one of our closest relatives that is frighteningly similar. Bonobos, on the other hand, as far as we know to date, there is not this darker side. No bonobo has ever been observed to kill another bonobo. Now, they hurt each other, for sure. Do not confuse what I'm saying to say they are nonviolent. They are not nonviolent. I just told you females chase and beat up males who try to beat them up. They use power, though, in a different way. Females use power to stop bullying, whereas chimpanzees use power to be bullies. So, when we're thinking about our own species, and when we're thinking about what intelligence is, they're really fun to challenge our notions. Because as amazing as we are, here we are being amazing, we have some problems. Things like the phobia of strangers, gang murder, sexual coercion, in some cases in the form of rape, sexual taboos, infanticide, and we already went to Vegas, a proclivity to gamble. So when we look at our closest relative, the chimpanzee, we've got a lot of evidence actually for at least analogous behaviors in all of these realms. So if you were to only consider chimpanzees, it's a little bit depressing. And none of these things are particularly unique, and there's a biological basis for them, and it's deeply rooted, and hopefully we can figure out culturally through institutions to deal with this problem, which is what we do all the time. Yes, we have these problems, and then look at bonobos. So, what a fun species to try to figure out. So I learned two things from this. One is, if you define intelligence by all the things we can do, we're pretty awesome. If you define it by the things we can't do, we're pretty pathetic. So what's happened as a result of the work with bonobos and trying to understand, basically I went to Congo, I go to Congo every year and work with bonobos at this orphanage, Lola Ya Bonobo, to try to understand their psychology. Because basically what I'm trying to tell you is, if you were going to understand the psychology of any organism on this planet, it is the bonobo. They can do the things that we can't do. And the dogs led me to them. Because what happened was, I studied my own dog, I then ended up studying the foxes, and the foxes told me that I should compare bonobos to chimpanzees. Because bonobos may have had selection against aggression that made them so dog-like in so many ways. So we've written a paper about it recently, arguing that natural selection has actually worked on bonobos just like Balaya worked on the foxes, and produced a species that biologically is capable of things that we can't. Its psychology has been shaped in a way that they can do things that our own species can't do. So of course, it's interesting to take these principles and now think about human evolution. Because the paradox, of course, is that we do have this darker side, but at the same time, we are capable of incredible compassion and incredible groupishness, as Jonathan Haidt calls it. So, unfortunately, bonobos are very endangered. I work all the time tirelessly to try to help protect them. That's another story, but back to dogs. So, we learn not only what's remarkable about dogs, but we've also learned what's remarkable, but now what we're trying to do is understand more about their psychology. How is it they solve problems? And we're asking all sorts of questions that you wouldn't think that you'd ask about dogs. And we've made all sorts of crazy discoveries. So for instance, and this is we in the royal sense of lots of my colleagues, have discovered things like there's a dog that learns words using the same mechanism that human infants use, called fast mapping. Only species other than our own to do this that we know of. Philip, a Belgian Tavurin, is incredible at mimicking human motion. If you do a motion pattern, so say you do a twirl and then you tap two things, Philip will do the analogous thing with his bodily constraints, spontaneously. And the idea is that we're using this information to try to help in applied situations, whether it is increasing the supply of service dogs or dogs that are companion or therapy animals. We work with the Canine Companions for Independence. We're also working with the Marine Corps to help improve the abilities of dogs to protect soldiers as well. Because actually, you may not know this, but it is still the number one most effective way to find IEDs is with a dog. As much money as we've spent on technology, dogs are by far the best. So quickly, what I want to do is introduce you to the idea that you can participate. Because that's the most exciting thing to me, was I started in my garage, my parents' garage, studying my own dog, and that's what got me started on this entire tour that I've taken you on. And I would like to share that with other people, that you can have the same experience with your own dog. So we created a company called Dognition, and the idea is to use the new way that we think about psychology, intelligence, this cognitive approach to animal psychology and potentially human psychology, and celebrate the fact that dogs are cognitive individuals. What is your dog's genius relative to other dogs? So we're going to help you measure five different things that we think are core competencies to being a dog. One is their empathy towards you, how cunning they are. Okay, who hasn't been deceived by their dog? How communicative they are in terms of understanding your gestures. How good are they at reasoning through inference? And what about their memory? The underlying assumption, and not only assumption, but we have great data, is there's tremendous individual variability within the species in all of these domains. No one has ever had a tool to allow us to measure it. Now we have it. You can learn about your own dog by playing games with them. You're going to discover what's extraordinary about your dog, and then we're going to help you figure out how to translate that into a richer relationship with your dog. We're working with lots of really exciting scientists, some of the top minds in animal cognition, and also some world-renowned behaviorists, animal behavior trainers. What does it look like? Well, you sign up. It costs money. You have to pay $60. You sign up, and you get access to the site. You play some fun games by watching a video that gives you detailed instructions. Here's an example, and then you start. And here's what you get is something like this, is some instructions. You can do it on your iPad or on your iPhone. You need your dog, some treats. You need like a few pieces of paper, those cups, and a couple of other things like sticky notes. And then you start your timer. And for instance here, you're going to say yellow every 5 seconds. And then for 2 minutes and 30 seconds, you're going to watch if your dog yawns. You're going to do it again after you yawn at your dog, because we know this is a wonderfully powerful measure of empathy, nonverbal. We know that autistic children have a hard time developing the ability to yawn. We know that animals yawn for individuals they are more closely bonded for. What does your dog do? Is your dog the dog that yawns like crazy when you yawn, or is your dog the one that doesn't really care if you yawn? That's how my dog is. Okay, and so after you've completed a series of 10 games, then you get a really comprehensive report that explains how your dog compares in its empathy to all the other dogs that have played this game. Where does it fall between being very individualistic and being incredibly bonded with you? And we'll help you understand across all the dimensions where your dog sits. And what's the science that led us to present these games as great measures of what your dog is about? But it's not just about your dog. The exciting thing is, since you all are very science-minded people, our current approach to doing science with dogs at Duke, we can pump out data on about 45 dogs a month on one game. But what Dognition already has shown through our beta or practice program that we did in the winter is we let people in for free to practice. We had 2,500 people sign up. We have data from hundreds of dogs, and we got data from 120 dogs a month on 10 different games. So for the first time ever, I have a decent sample size to answer some questions that we all want to know the answer to that I can't go ask normal granting agencies to help me with. For instance, who doesn't want to know if a Great Dane has better memory than a Chihuahua? But I don't think the National Institute of Health is going to help us fund that research. But we can answer that question with Dognition. As citizen scientists get excited about learning more about dogs, we can answer silly questions like that, that actually in many ways could be really important. But we can also answer some really fun and some really important questions that can enrich our relationship. So here's some of my studies are in here. This is the sample size, you know, a dozen or more dogs. This was our beta program, and we're building towards something really, really big. And the idea is, with that power, we'll be able to answer some questions that are just unanswerable otherwise. So go find the genius in your dog, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Brian. You're listening to the Natural History Museum of Utah's Nature of Things lecture series on KCPW 88.3 and 105.3 FM in Salt Lake City. I have two quick announcements before we have questions. First of all, I invite you to come see Weaving a Revolution. It's an exhibit of Navajo baskets. It only will be at the museum for 3 more weeks. We have an event every weekend between now and closing, Navajo rug auction this Saturday, and then Weavers, both of the following 2 weekends are coming up from the reservation. And then I also want to let you know that Brian will be signing books. We don't have any for sale, I'm sorry, we sold out. But if you brought one of his books, he's happy to sign it for you after the lecture outside. So with this, we have Lisa and Jesse, have microphones. Raise your hand and make sure you answer or ask your question into the microphone.
Thank you. So getting... So getting back to the first test you showed us with the water and the peanuts, do we know that she hadn't seen something like that before? And along the same lines, have you had luck asking your patients if they had seen it before?
So I don't work with patients, so I'm not sure which, you mean children?
No, the animals.
Okay, all right, sorry. So we don't ask them if they've seen it before, but because we've raised them, we know. So these are captive animals. So they usually are orphaned at between 2 and 3 years of age, and then they're brought to these sanctuaries. Unfortunately, their whole families are killed, and then people are trying to sell them as pets. They are beautifully taken care of. I could show you some amazing videos. I can tell you if you're a captive ape, you want to live in a sanctuary in Africa. Yo-Yo, for instance, has 100 acres of primary tropical rainforest. But it's pretty sure that the forest doesn't have any PVC pipes. So we're pretty confident that she probably hasn't seen it before. Water, she has seen water, obviously. And peanuts, she's seen peanuts. But I don't think she's ever seen peanuts in tubes before. She may have, yes. And so then that's the fun thing about being a psychologist is you then can think about, okay, is it an inference? Which kind of inference? Is this foresight? Is this insight? And certainly you can think about the mechanism. And if you read the actual paper, they go to great lengths to try to figure out exactly what was she doing. But the fun thing is 4 or 5 year old kids struggle with that. And if we had you come up here, when I do that, I can tell you that adults do some funny stuff.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I thought it was amazing. I'm mostly interested if you have an opinion as to the way that we're constructed mentally and the similarities with animals, and if that extends our ethical obligations to them, mm-hmm. and if things such as factory farms can mm-hmm. be ethically justified, or if mm-hmm. we'll one day view those with disgust. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What a cool question. So I think that what's happened is what's happened in lots of charged debates is it's very easy to start yelling and polarize things. I didn't get to talk about it, but I think the paradox of humans is solved if you think about, meaning violence and aggression in humans. How can we be so nice and be so awful at the same time? Well, there's some wonderful research, and partly why we're really interested in the comparison of chimps and bonobos, is this idea of in-group and out-group. So humans are lambs as long as you think the person you're interacting with is like you. Whatever the cue is that you use, it can be color, what you eat, the book bag you're wearing, whether it's on both shoulders or one, you know, what tattoo you have, who your mother went to school with. In-group can be assigned in humans incredibly, frighteningly flexibly. But if you view somebody as like you, you're a lamb. If you view somebody as not like you, then we are far worse than chimpanzees. So I think that there's a psychological tendency in any debate to polarize. And you're not like me or you are like me. Okay, so I just want to say that I think that's the normal thing. And what's happened is it's us versus the animals. Either the animals are going to be happy and we're going to have to eat worms, or maybe even not worms, maybe just plants, or we're just going to keep it the way that it is and we can have our nice steaks. But I think we can have that debate and we can talk about, does animal cognition have any relevance? But for me, my own take and my own emphasis in this debate is there's a very important thing that gets drowned, which is the animals in the cages right now, while everybody's yelling, trying to be right. So I'm a big proponent of welfare, which I think is a very different thing than a rights approach. And the idea is, whether or not you think animals have rights or not, whether you think they're smart enough, sentient, et cetera, which we could debate and we could start yelling at each other, it happens. animals need the best welfare possible. But unfortunately, on both sides, they're so busy yelling that nobody's working on how to improve animal welfare. How do you test an animal's preference for where it wants to be or how it wants to be kept? So that would be my take, is that what I do know is that we could do a lot better job with some very, very simple ideas. I'll just give you one concrete example. When I was in Siberia, they do not have the same ideas about welfare that we do. And I just gave a yogurt container every day to a fox. They played with it for hours and had a great time. All it took was me putting a yogurt container in the fox cage. It didn't cost any money. I already ate the yogurt. So that's what I mean, is what if then the Russians said, hey, let's have all the foxes every day have that. That's better than what they have now, which is nothing. So that's welfare, and nobody's investing, and nobody's doing any research.
I noticed that most of the examples you use to illustrate social referencing involve rewards mm-hmm. and information about gains. Have you looked mm-hmm. at social referencing for fear to show if a human actively avoids something as a source of danger or disgust? How do dogs, chimps, and mm-hmm. bonobos code that mm-hmm. information?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I am blanking on whether somebody's done a disgust experiment with dogs. So I would have to lie to you about that if I told you something. So I don't want to do that. So I do know that we've done experiments with bonobos and chimpanzees where if we show fear, they will actually, in some cases, be more interested in finding out what it is. I think if they see another conspecific, another of their own species show a fear response, they tend to avoid whatever it is. But in the case of humans, it's like, the human's freaked out. What is that? So with dogs, they certainly respond to whether you are anxious or not. Disgust, I'm not sure.
I've got a real quick question. Dogs see in color?
Yes and no.
Can you repeat
the question? Sure. The question was, do dogs see in color? And the answer is yes and no. So the argument that I've seen in the literature is that they basically don't see the same colors and as wide of a color spectrum as we do, but they do see color.
Ever since Descartes observed in his mind that animals function purely mechanically, that thought until recently prevailed in academe. I wonder if you'd studied what is the limitation in the mind of academics that can't perceive the obvious that animals, especially dogs, do feel emotion and reason at a certain level.
I think a lot of them don't have dogs. I don't know. Help an academic buy them a dog. I don't know. It's a great question. I don't know. I mean, I think what happens is, depending on the field and the perspective you take, it's very hard to remember to go observe the real world after you've read a bunch of stuff. And so I imagine that's part of it, if that helps.
Hi, Dr. Hare. You mentioned that dogs are good at taking cues from one another, social cues from one another. How did you test this? And I'm curious as to how chimps, both bonobos and common chimps, compare on taking cues from one another. Mm-hmm. In addition to, you mm-hmm. talked about how they can take cues from humans. How do they take cues from each other?
So the study where we looked at whether dogs pay attention to the information of other dogs, there was a wonderful Labrador retriever named Maggie. And she was about 3 years old and unfortunately had hip dysplasia and arthritic back legs, which meant that she held perfectly still. And so you could just place her in orientation of towards one cup or the other, and she would just stand there. And so then we could look at whether they used her orientation to decide where to go. And obviously we were very sensitive to the fact that she was needed to amble slowly to her position. But she got lots of treats. She had fun. On conspecifics, bonobos and chimpanzees, it's really interesting because one of the hypotheses I've chased is the idea that this context, what's going on with chimpanzees and bonobos, especially chimpanzees, is that It's a cooperative and communicative context. So chimpanzees and bonobos are fantastic at cooperating. They're also pretty decent at communicating. But what I think is special is here, you have to cooperate and communicate. You have to understand that he's trying to help me by telling me something that I don't know. Now, it may not be that cognitively rich, but at least motivationally, you have to know, oh, he's trying to help me. Because if you're an ape, why wouldn't you just eat the food instead of pointing it out to somebody else? What's the context in which an ape would say, oh, there's the one grape left. They're not going to do that. They're going to go eat it. So maybe bonobos. But when we do the exact same game, but we make it competitive, so now it is I'm looking in a certain direction, and if you actually try to go in that direction, I'm going to steal the food. But if you go in the direction I'm not looking and I can't quite see what you're doing, it's the exact same information. It's the direction my head's turned. They're really good at that. And they spontaneously solve that problem. So one of our hypotheses is it's a motivational and contextual problem. What's special about humans is when we're trying to use each other's information, we understand this is a cooperative context. You're trying to help me find this, and that's really weird. And another piece of evidence, if you don't believe me, is has anybody ever met somebody without white sclera? Sclera is the white in our eyes. So we're the only primate that has white sclera, where it's incredibly visible. What a dumb thing to do if you're trying to hide information from others. Here's where I'm looking. So it's even in our eyes that we have evolved to be super cooperative.
So I have two questions. So my dog, well, so there's this dog that lives on our street, and my dog absolutely hates him. Like,
uh-oh.
Yeah, like he has very violent, he's very violent towards him. Like, so he's not violent. He's not like this to any other dogs, just this dog. And I was just wondering, like, what does he, like, do? Like, what kind of things does he give off, like, that dog gives off to my dog? Like, what does that, what is that? And also, you probably get this question a lot, but when dogs bark, is that just a noise, or do they have, like, is that a language? Like, do they have words in the language?
Cool.
Yeah.
So your first question, I don't know the answer. And part of my job as a scientist is to say when I don't know something, and I don't know, because it's really complicated. Aggression is super complicated. And I don't think we understand very well why some dogs might bite children and another dog might be really aggressive towards other dogs. We have great stories about it. You know, oh, border collies are really aggressive, or this breed, pit bulls are really aggressive. But in the end, when you go look at the scientific literature and you try to figure it out, oh, which one's the aggressive breed, it's a disaster. There's no real good evidence that any one breed is more aggressive than the other, or that one breed shows, except for maybe your terriers, like Jack Russells. I think that we might know. Don't ever tell a Jack Russell it's small. It won't believe you. I think it's really hard to know why dogs are aggressive towards other dogs, or why they're aggressive towards people or not. It's a tough problem. But you know, I do think there are people who work with dogs and try to help them deal with those problems. There's some things you can do. Why that dog may have something against that certain dog, I don't know. It could be something about the behavior of the other dog. It could be something about you know, something totally unrelated to that dog. It'd be actually the dogs tend to urinate there, and maybe it's always some estrus female who's urinating there, and it happens that dog's male, and is your dog male, female? Male, and it just makes him upset. There's another male near this. I mean, I don't know. I could make up 100 stories. But thankfully, on your barking question, I have an answer. And on barking, we review in the book the data so far that we have. And I think one of the assumptions has been, I mean, dogs bark and it's just a bunch of noise. And most people would like that their dog barked less. But there's some really nice work now showing that the vocalizations that dogs are making, well, the first thing to know about barking, which is really fun, is that wolves pretty much don't bark. They bark when there is an intruder. So wolves are like chimpanzees. They are very xenophobic, and they actually are one of the only other mammals that will seek out and kill their neighbors. So they bark in these inner group or when you meet a stranger. And they also bark when they're young, but that's about it. And so the fact that then what we've discovered is that when you look at the vocal apparatus of dogs, and when you look, not me, but others have looked at the vocal apparatus, and when people have looked at the structure of barks, there's a lot of indication that there's something in there, that it mean, different barks mean different things. People have behaviorally done experiments. They've played different barks, and dogs actually can discriminate between, for instance, that dog's playing, that dog is interacting with its owner, that dog is interacting is barking at a stranger, that dog's lonely. They actually can discriminate the different barks. Now, the fun thing is when you do this with people and you play the barks, and it's one of the things we're going to do at Dognition, is we're going to put some of these vocalizations up and see how good people are at discriminating between them. But the studies that have been done so far, it ends up people are really good at understanding when their own dog is barking at a stranger. But other than that, people aren't very good at discriminating between different barks. So we review it in the book, but it's a great question.
My question is about dogs and televisions. We have a Chihuahua. I really think she's more Jack Russell than Chihuahua. But she will sit for 10, 15 minutes and watch animals on television.
I love her already.
And the minute she sees people and no animals, she loses interest. So just curious if you've done any research on, because I've heard that dogs can't watch television because they can't smell the animals, but she will growl at the animals.
I love it. Okay, so what we tried to do in the book, and thankfully my wife helped me write the book, it means that you can read it and enjoy it, is I literally spent months combing through the literature trying to look at everything that science had done in terms of studying dogs. And we tried to offer a comprehensive view, as much as we can in 80,000 words. So if you turn to the back of the book, you'll see 70 pages of endnotes. It's all the citations of the scientific research. So if you don't believe me, good for you, one. And two, you can go read it yourself and find out if we're full of it. Okay. But we say in the preface of the book, part of the problem with the approach we took is that we're being scientists. And that means that a lot of the things we're all really interested in, I have no answer for. Because the way that science works is there's a big question. It has to be relevant to something that might have to do with humans or something that is biologically relevant. And then you design a study, you try to go get money for it, and it's funded or not. So in this case, I would love to know what your Chihuahua's doing. But I can just imagine writing the National Science Foundation or the National Institute of Health, you know, hypothesis one. Chihuahua knows they're real animals. Hypothesis two, they're reacting to motion. And maybe that would be interesting. Maybe you could do it in a really cool way. But nobody's done that yet. And so I think that's one of the fun things about citizen science and about Dognition is that by doing it through a private vehicle, we can actually ask things that we all want to know the answer to and not worry about having to get the National Science Foundation excited about it. You know, one of the things we'll do in the future is let people propose studies and observations, because there's so many. I mean, just imagine me going to my advisor and say my dog does this thing. Or imagine how Rico was discovered, the dog that fast maps and learns words as quickly as human infants, or Chaser. The way that Rico was discovered was Rico's owner saw some folks from the institute where they ended up doing the research on television. And she contacted them and said, my dog does this funny thing. You know, what is it? And then it's in science, what it is. A very esteemed scientific publication. So I think owners have a lot to offer. And I don't have an answer for your question. I'm sorry.
In the book, Demonic Males, it mentioned that whenever you turn over foreign policy to males, it's always aggressive. and that patriotism breeds aggression. I'm wondering if you have a view on whether we should turn over our foreign policy to females. It also mentioned that it would take 200 to 300 years, if the human species evolved so long, to achieve the same level of enlightenment as the bonobos. I'm wondering, why did the bonobos reach such a level of enlightenment, and it's going to take us 200 to 300 more years if we are, in fact, the superior species on the planet?
So if I don't agree with you, I'm going to be in big trouble in this crowd. So I think it's... I might be corrected. So I'm going to agree with you, because that seems very safe. No, I do actually agree with you. But what I just want to say is, whoever is doing foreign policy, I think it would be really good to know that, you know, there is a biological basis to aggression, that there is this inescapable problem of being human, that we immediately categorize whoever it is we meet as in-group and out-group. We can't help it. It happens. There's beautiful, I mean, there's wonderful study in infants before they've been corrupted by whatever culture it is they're in. We know from, obviously, non-humans that this is something that exists in other species. So, sadly, I don't want you to walk away thinking there's nothing to do about it, because we're not saying that just because there's a biological basis that there's nothing to do. In fact, it's quite the opposite. But I think one of the things that I was sad about, or worried, I should say, not sad, worried, was when Obama was elected, I don't know whether it was the New York Times or CNN had a headline, have we entered the post-racial period? And the answer is no, we never will, unless it's a different species we're talking about. And so that's the unfortunate, you know, but then empowering lesson, is there is a biological basis, and we have to build institutions to be forever aware of this, whoever's in charge, male or female, and that, you know, there has to be, you know, institutions and cultural norms need to be designed around that. Of course, I would love it if, you know, females were involved in making foreign policy. I do think that things would be better in many ways, as long as they didn't then blame the males for everything and start correcting them all the time, like bonobo females do.
I was just very interested in, you were talking about context with your learning and whether dogs cue from dogs. I've actually done some studies with coyotes.
Oh, cool.
And mm-hmm. social learning. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that dominance overrode information use. So mm-hmm. you give the information to the subordinate, mm-hmm. does the dominant learn from that or mm-hmm. use their own? And I wondered if you had found any kind of social hierarchy
in dogs.
Context to it, yeah.
So there is some wonderful primate work not unlike that. Where, and even in humans, you know, people have done ethological studies where they just observe humans like in a board meeting or whatever. You look at who's looking at who, and all the attention, especially if it's a group of males, is on whoever the CEO or whatever, whoever supposedly has all the power, all the attention is on that individual. It's not distributed equally between different individuals. And when you look at primate social learning, often, you know, you can have problems learning, actually, if you have a huge difference in your dominance between two individuals, well, you may need to either work together or learn from each other, but because you can't get along, you can't do it. And alternatively, because it's a dominant doing it, you might pay attention more than another individual. You might learn the wrong thing. On dogs, it's really a fun topic, and we talk about it in the book, because I think that when people think about the social system of dogs, what is the social system of dogs? I mean, we have dogs in our houses, but what is the social system? Meaning, do they have a really strong dominance hierarchy? Are they female dominated? Are they male? I mean, do they live in big packs? Do they live in packs? Well, what historically has happened is people say, oh, what are wolves like? They're so like wolves. But of course, the problem is that what makes evolution so hard for so many people, including scientists that I interact with, so hard to get is it's descent with modification. So it means you're the same and different at the same time. And so in the case of social system, okay, yeah, there are similarities we talk about in the book, you know, pack size between wolves and the group I think we should be comparing our dogs to, feral dogs, are about the same. You have, you know, multi-male, multi-female, they're pretty gregarious, they stay together, etc. But when you look at dominance hierarchy in feral dogs, it's very, very hard to find one. And in fact, if you look at, so reproductive suppression, zero in feral dogs. You don't have cooperative breeding where basically your mate is helping provision the offspring and you as you protect your offspring when they're young, which means mortality rates in feral dogs is horrendous. So Bob Barker's right, spay and neuter your dog, because it's hard to be a feral dog. But the one thing that's really interesting is who's the leader in a feral dog pack? Well, if you're a wolf, it's whoever is the dominant breeding pair. You follow them to go find whatever it is you're going to go hunt that day. In feral dog packs, when people have looked, it's actually the individual with the most affiliative relationships in the pack. That's who's followed. So they have a shallow dominance hierarchy, and they do not have a clear dominant individual, at least in feral dogs. I think when you start talking about our dogs that we interact with on a daily basis, there's such a huge size discrepancy that then there is clear dominance hierarchies and dominance asymmetries. But if you look at feral dog social system, actually the dominance hierarchy is not there.
All right, can you hear me?
Yes.
You know, human psychologists make a big distinction between human beings thinking fast versus thinking slow. Fast means instinctively, and thinking slow is more analytic. And I'm wondering if you've done tests with dogs. You know, are there situations where a dog would respond instinctively to a certain environmental change versus something where he didn't or she didn't experience before? And we sort of ponder the situation, and it's almost as if they were analytically coming up with the response.
Yeah, no, that's neat. I like that a lot. So one of the things, just to repeat the logic here, is that if it's something that's really important, like being fearful of snakes, you respond reflexively, and you have a really strong emotion, and you sort of try to turn away or get away. Whereas if it's something that doesn't really elicit a strong response or survival is related to survival, then you're more likely to sort of process it in a slower manner and maybe see solutions to problems you wouldn't if it was processed really fast. I'm not aware of anybody using that technique or thinking in that way about dogs yet. But this is the fun thing. This is the beginning. We're on a very steep trajectory. One of my postdocs just sent me a slide of publications on dogs, and it looks like this. I mean, it's going, but it's a 10-year slide, and so we went from basically zero publications to now there's about 40 a year worldwide. But I mean, if you compare how many publications are on humans, it's not very many. So it's exciting, but it's not as big as we might hope. That is really cool. I mean, there are so many neat things that we could do, and that's a great example where you could think about. Another one that's great is like no one's done a comparison of short and long-term memory, and is there you could even use that paradigm to look at that. Where would you expect things to be encoded into long-term memory for later use, depending on how relevant it is to survivorship. Back over here.
Yeah, can you hear me over there?
Yes.
I think probably everybody here has heard a story or read a book or watched a movie about the people that take off with their dog, and they live in California and they lose them in Pennsylvania, and X number of months later, they find their way home. I noticed in the beginning of your presentation you had a navigation as a intelligence point. Do dogs have something that, or are they just really lucky?
So we talk about this in the book, and again, I address it as a scientist. And so I can tell you, I'll start as a scientist and I'll tell you it as a person. So, because I can play by different rules. So as a scientist, I have to rely on the literature. And all I can tell you is that dogs are wholly unremarkable. in their ability to navigate and solve navigational problems. So people like myself who study animal cognition and dogs cognition specifically, we've said things, and what I say in the book is, you know, I think dogs that are getting found like that are incredibly lucky, because I think that's very unusual. And especially if you think about the tens of thousands of dogs every year that go stray and get lost and never get found. But it still is really funny to read the newspaper article. There was one recently where a dog was lost in northern Florida, and then it found its way back to Miami. And the best was that thankfully they called me. They called one of my colleagues as the scientist, you know, to get the scientific opinion about this. And he said, well, it could be this, and it could be that, and is it even the same dog? And he went through all these alternative hypotheses, and the reporter completely shot down every alternative hypothesis. You know, the dog was chipped, and no, the dog's feet, where it didn't ride in a car because the dog's feet were raw. So I'm so glad it wasn't me. So I say that because I don't know how they do it. Maybe there are certain dogs that can do this. And again, it's back to the question about watching TV. There are things as a scientist, I can't tell you the answer. Nobody has come up with a way to address it. And it's rare occurrences like this that are fascinating. Somebody needs to start collecting these anecdotes and interviewing people and seeing if there's something in common. And let's look at these dogs and maybe we play some games with them. Maybe they have memory or some navigational ability that's different. Or maybe there's some explanation for it that something else. Okay. Great. Oh, let's let him ask the question. Sorry. We can talk after. Sure.
Wow, that's kind of loud. You did a test on the bonobos, yes. How they prefer to share with another kind of their species rather than just eat it by themselves. Did you do that with, like, dogs or other kinds of animals?
Interesting. Not yet.
Okay.
No. I don't think there's anything similar. And I think what happened was that the student I showed you, she said she thought this might happen. And I said, I think you're wrong. Mm-hmm. So then we did the experiment, and she was right, which is really fun. And so now we've published the study. So we shared it with other scientists. And they've said, OK, you did a decent job in the experiment. And so now that we kind of have a method, it's going to be really fun to find out if other species do the same thing. Okay. But I can't tell you right now. We haven't done the same thing with other species.
Thank you.
Great question.
Thank you all, and we'll look forward to seeing you at next year's Nature of Things lecture series.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.